A sermon by Reverend Richard A. Rem, preached at Christ Community Church in Spring Lake, Michigan, on August 3, 1997, in the series Tough Questions, No Easy Answers, entitled, Why is there so much anger in religion? The texts for the sermon are Jonah 3 and 4, James 1, verses 19 through 27, and Luke 15, verses 25 through 32. Copyright, Grand Valley State University.
Preaching is fascinating business. Sometimes I think it'll kill me, but I'd die without it. And I find that when I create a sermon series, I have something in mind, and then I get into it. And there are levels and layers much deeper than I realized in the beginning. This series, Tough Questions, No Easy Answers, kind of obvious questions that one thinks about when one thinks about religious experience. But as I get into them, the questions, I realize that I'm not dealing just with a question, but I'm dealing more with the phenomenon of religion itself. For example, why is there so much anger in religion? That drives me to look at religion, to look again at its origins, at its function in society and in human personality, to see what purpose it is fulfilling, what are the dynamics of religion in a person, in society, as we experience it. Why is there so much anger in religion? And I have to ask, well, what is religion? What's going on? What are we doing this morning? What do we do in our closet, in our devotion? What is the nature of the religious experience? And I realize that religion is a human creation. That's rather obvious when you think about it, but it's not at all obvious in the way we have traditionally treated religion. It's more often treated as something that fell right down out of heaven, something direct from the hand of God that we simply enter into. But no, it's not. It's a human creation. It's a human structure that we put together. And we put it together because along about 15 billion years into this cosmic drama, there appeared creatures like us who became self-conscious and aware and realized that we were going to die, and realize that those of our intimate circle would die. And we began to ask, why must we die? All flesh is mortal. Why is all flesh mortal? As we developed this consciousness and a spiritual capacity, as we began to more and more be able to jump out of our skin and look down on ourselves and reflect on our society, we began to see that tragic thread that is woven through human experience. And we become aware of, through our own experience or the experience of others, the reality of suffering. Suffering for which there seems no rational explanation. And we begin to ask, whence do we come? Have we come? And whither are we going? And in the meantime, what is the meaning of it all? What is the meaning of life? What is the meaning of death? We may, those who talk about these things, speak about the boundary situations when we run up against life's limits. And out of that experience of running up against those limits, those boundary situations, those existential questions about ultimate reality, out of that, we put together a system of ideas and of practices and a manner of behavior. We put together a religious structure. It's a human creation. Ludwig Feuerbach, the German philosopher, theologian, said it so concisely in the 19th century. He said it so concisely and it made so much sense that he opened the door to modern atheism. Karl Marx followed him, switching the focus from heaven to earth and speaking about the transformation of the historical scene through class warfare. And Freud followed him, seeking to solve the human dilemma by psychoanalysis, by the neutralizing of the distortion of the unconscious and of early infancy experiences. And Nietzsche followed him, who celebrated the will to power and the Superman, who said, God is dead, all is permitted. Of course, the church got its back up and became defensive. A rather normal, natural kind of reaction. But unfortunately, rather than listening to Feuerbach, rather than seeing the acuteness of the critique, it was simply denied. Rather than recognizing the ring of reality there and the sense that it made of human religion, arising out of human experience, the church simply shouted louder and said it wasn't true, failing to recognize that there was only one critical point in order to continue the intelligent practice of religion, and that was to deny Feuerbach at the key proposition, namely, that religion simply arises out of human need. And in its place to assert that religion arises as a human response in the midst of all of the anguish of the human situation to an encounter from beyond. That there is a mystery that places us in question. That it is the question. The question from beyond, or the question out of the depths, addressed to our existential situation, which is fraught with anguish and vulnerability and fragility and peril. Out of that human context, being placed in question, we respond with our religion. Some prophet or sage has a founding vision. And out of that founding vision comes a way of devotion or worship, a cult. And that founding vision issues in a way of life or a code of behavior or a moral code. And so we have a vision, a truth, a doctrine, a teaching, a manner of devotion, and a way of life, and that's religion. And it's a human creation. But it is a human creation in response to the encounter from beyond, and our religious systems that we construct and our patterns of religious behavior that we follow are the means by which we exercise that yearning within to have some experience of that mystery beyond us that confronts us, that is present to us, but is always, always beyond our grasp. Never, never able to be domesticated and brought under control. That's the nature of religion. And the more I think about it, the more I recognize how, if only we could have gotten that straight a long time ago, we would have handled our religious experience in a much more healthy fashion than we have. But if that is the nature of religion, then certainly there's a very positive function for it. It's a coping device. It's the means by which we make meaning out of life. It is the means by which we negotiate life's passages. That's a very positive function. That's a very important thing. We need that. Life is tough. Life is filled with mystery and suffering. We need a way to believe and to worship and to live Religion has a very positive, critical role in human society. That's obviously why it's universal. But if it has that positive role and function, then tell me, why is there so much anger in religion? Now, I don't mean the kind of anger that Jesus manifests at the temple when he saw the abuse of the system, when people were abused. There's all kinds of things going on in the world that ought to cause us to be angry because they are wrong, they are dehumanizing, they are abusive. Wherever we encounter that, then if we follow the way of Jesus, there is an anger in us that wants to straighten that out and make it right. Not that kind of anger. I'm talking about the kind of anger that was manifested again this week when in a crowded marketplace in Jerusalem, the bombs went off, suicide bombers. Suicide bombers who took with them other lives and injured so many more, continuing to bring terror into that old holy city. I'm talking about the kind of anger that must be operative in that Brooklyn apartment where such an attack was preempted in our own country this week. I'm talking about the kind of anger that we read about, unfortunately, daily, from the respective fundamentalisms of Judaism and Christianity and Islam. Now, religion is not the sole source of the violence. There are exploitative politicians who will co-opt religion for their own secular purposes, obviously. And thinking about Islam, centuries, generations of cultural humiliation for which we bear some responsibility, issues in anger. But in all of that, intertwined, interwoven in all of that is the religion which provides fuel and provides motivation and provides reward. The two suicide bombers in the Jerusalem market were promised that in their martyrdom, immediately they would be issued into paradise. But we don't even need to go to those fanatical expressions where the anger is so obvious that it spills out all over the place. We've got enough anger all around us. I remember in the years in which I was writing in the Theological Journal, I got so many letters to the editor, and so many of them were so angry. I wanted to say, well, let's talk about the issue. But it was much easier, it seemed more natural to attack personally the threat to the system or the idea or the teaching or the institution or whatever. Anger, just under the surface in a lot of religious people. Good people and sincere people who are living very uptight lives, ready to explode. Why is that? If religion has such a positive function and plays such a critical role, why is it that there's so much anger in religion and religious people? Well, it's a tough question, and I haven't promised you any easy answers, and I'm not going to claim this morning that I have that all analyzed down to the nth degree. I want to say some things that I think at least play into that anger and are the cause of that hostile spirit that pervades so much of the religious institution, broadly speaking. Charles Davis, whom I quote in your liturgy in a rather lengthy quote, is a very acute observer of religions, as far as I'm concerned, and has put his finger on the anger of morality in the chapter that I quote. But he acknowledges the necessity of institutions and structures in society. Good grief, we need them. Life is chaotic enough. We need organization. We need institutions. We need structures. And it is the story of human society. There is some explosive vision. There is some joyous celebration and movement. The movement becomes regularized and normalized. The movement becomes sterile and dead. And unfortunately, it doesn't go away. It hangs on for a while. But that's the way it is. And we couldn't really exist as a people, as a society, as a global population without institutional forms and structures. But Davis says it is the temptation of institutions, social structures, whether they be religious or secular, but we're talking about the religious, it is the temptation of institutions to absolutize themselves. What they should be are mediatory agents. Institutions, talking in religion now, the church, for example, creedal forms, liturgical forms, ecclesiastical forms, all of that apparatus of our religious experience ought to be an immediatory function. It ought to be enabling you and I to be in touch with that transcendent mystery. It ought to usher us in to the experience of God. It ought to be the means by which we are touched by the infinite one. It is always the temptation to absolutize the institution or the structure or the teaching or the form. And then you get leadership in institutions that will eventually have a vested interest in the perpetuation of that institution in its present form. I'm not telling you anything new. You can see it every day, anywhere you look. So that from the top down, there is high motivation to absolutize the institution and keep it going. Years and years ago, the great monarchies, the kings of England, for example, they reigned by the divine right, did they not? Wouldn't you like to reign by divine right? If you were a king, who could touch you? As long as the people believed it. As long as the people believe that you were on the throne by the mercy of God, who could touch you? It was not until that myth was broken, when it was recognized that it wasn't God that put the king on the throne, that the king on the throne by divine right could be abusive, could be everything a king ought not to be, and still not be touched. I would like to reign by divine right. I've often said I'd be willing to be a Roman Catholic if I could be a cardinal. Because if I could be a cardinal, I'd have a shot at being the Pope. And if I were the Pope, top-down control, hierarchy, authoritarian structures, absolutized, not simply because they make sense, not simply because they're old, but because they come from heaven, that God gave us those structures, those forms. So we have an institutional life in which love and freedom and creativity and spontaneity is choked. And there is an authoritarian grip that squeezes the life and quenches the spirit. And it's absolutized when, as a matter of fact, it is a human structure. But probably nowhere like in the church have the people been more passive. Why have you put up with it? Why have people remained so sheep-like in institutional absolutism? Well, maybe because you got enough going in the rest of your life, you'd like to just come here and be told how it is and what you ought to do. Throw in a buck or two and you're home free, promised eternal life, no problem. Don't bother me to stretch and grow and think for myself. All too often the people have traded in comfort and security in exchange for their own vital, personal, passionate faith. And so there's trouble from the top down, and there's fault from the bottom up. And consequently, what has been created is an absolutism which has promised what it cannot deliver. And then, when someone shakes the foundation or questions the absolute validity of some idea, some teaching, some program, some ritual, some practice, since I haven't thought it through myself and made what I do and believe and follow my own, that external system which has been placed upon me now being shaken threatens my whole being, and it makes me angry. Because what has been promised to me is not being delivered. There is within the human heart a lust for certitude and a search for security. There is a legitimate request for comfort, of course. But in the church, we haven't been honest. Because what we have promised isn't possible being human as we are. There is no absolutism that is possible within the human experience. For if religion is our response to the absolute, then that response is relative. It is partial. It is tentative. It is provisional, and it must always be open to revision. I received from a friend a copy of an article from a hyper-Calvinist journal this week, in which hands were wrung and tears shed over my heresy. But I, poor pipsqueak, am not to be to blame. My poor dead mentor, Hendrikus Berkhof, is the fault. Because he did not see the Bible as the only perfect and complete Word of God, absolutely infallible and inerrant, necessary for our salvation. Now, if you've got a book that came down from heaven, there's no argument. You have a text. You win the day, except if they really studied the book. It is so full of contending opinions that any intelligent analysis would see how ridiculous such a claim is. But in this article, there was nothing of the humility of the poet who said, our little systems have their day, they have their day and cease to be. They are but broken lights of thee, and thou, O Lord, art more than they. There was not the self-awareness to recognize that God's way is not synonymous with our way. You know what the article was entitled? God's Way or No Way. Not even the humility to say my sense or apprehension of God's way. How much better, how much more breath, fresh air there was to breathe in Karen Armstrong's lectures that we heard recently, who spoke about the creative imagination in shaping new images of God in this time of waiting in the darkness. I've mentioned before, she pointed to the English poet Keats, who spoke of negative capability being that capability to wait in the darkness without certainties, in ambiguity, without the irritable reaching for fact or reason. And I was so delighted when I came across Kathleen Norris's most recent book, The Cloister Walk, when she has a chapter entitled Exile, Homeland, and Negative Capability. And at the head of the chapter is that quotation from John Keats. And Kathleen Norris talks about her experience of going into elementary classrooms as a poet, where she reads to the students, and then she encourages them to write. And she says, you know, it is the good students that can't do it. They're so frustrated. I know that firsthand. I could master the system. I could get an A on any course where it was clear what the assignment was, what the content was. I could regurgitate it, boom, just like that. But you put me into a creative exercise that leveled the playing ground, and I didn't like it. Kathleen Norris said, I go into these classrooms, and it's the poor students who respond in a moment. She said, I tell them, you don't have to spell check. You can write through the margins. You can erase. Just don't worry about all those things that you have been so meticulously taught by your teachers to do. Just let it flow. And she says, the poor students go wild. They're creative. For the first time, they can express themselves. And then she says, what would it be like if from children we were introduced to life as mystery? If we were taught to cultivate negative capability rather than be force-fed and spoon-fed little answers of a system that has been reduced down to nothing with no spirit or life, with no mystery? What would it be like if in the church we raised up people who recognized that faith was a process, that life is full of mystery and ambiguity, that it takes discipline, listening heart, hard work, struggle, patience? We haven't been honest with people in the church. We've promised what we cannot deliver. Much rather, we should have said to the people, life is full of tough questions without easy answers. Those clear-cut absolutes, they're human constructions, and you'll run afoul of them at some point in your human experience. But in the darkness, you can trust. In the darkness, you can wait. And light will break into the darkness now and again, here and there. Why is there so much anger in religion? I think it's because we've promised a kind of absoluteness that doesn't exist. The kind of clarity and security that is unavailable being human as we are. And we've pawned off on people the system that they could carry around external to their own inward conviction, which systems crumble, leaving them exposed and angry. Why do you think Jonah is in the Hebrew Bible? Is it not a parable told by a Hebrew sage to address that exclusionary spirit that wants only my kind and no one more, that resents the wideness of God's mercy that embraces other races, ethnic groups, other creedal commitments, the wideness of God's mercy? Jonah was so angry. So angry. He was afraid God wouldn't damn the Ninevites because he said, I knew you were merciful and gracious. That's why I went the other way. Do you do well to be angry, Jonah? Jonah, if you think about it, you don't do well. You grieve the loss of a plant over which you labored not, that was here today and gone tomorrow. Should I not have compassion on all of those poor lost souls who know not what they do? I suppose the only more poignant picture of the ugliness of that human exclusionary spirit and anger is the elder brother in the story Jesus told, who was offended at the joy, who couldn't share the celebration, who wouldn't go into the party. He was angry. He was sincere and religious, serious. But his religion was an onerous task. And he operated on the performance principle. And he was offended by a God whose grace knows no limit and who refuses to operate according to the meritorious scales of human judgment. Oh, Jonah. Oh, elder brother. You're missing so much. I grieve for those under whose surface I sense a seething cauldron of anger. It's no way to live, friend. It is no way to live. It is so self-destructive, so dangerous for the world, and misses so much the wonder of the mercy of